Welcome to Pod 256, a weekly Bitcoin podcast focused on mining, energy, and proof of work. This is the first episode, and I'm your host, Rob, and I go by the handle BitKite on Twitter. Joining me this week, and I hope more often, is Colin Harper, writer and researcher at Luxor Technologies, a firm focused on Bitcoin mining software and services. How the heck are you, Colin?
Doing amazing, Rod. Thank you so much for having me on for this first episode. Really honored and thrilled to be a part of the inaugural episode of Pod 256.
There we go, man. We had a great rip on another podcast that I do, which is Builders in Bitcoin, a podcast focused on the people that bring Bitcoin to life. And I thought that rip was just so much fun. And I thought, hey, why don't we just create a weekly Bitcoin mining show? I'm a miner and I'm very interested in mining. That's fortunately and unfortunately, especially where we are today. So where are we today? So at the time of this recording, here's a quick rundown of some stats. So I'm checking mempool.space and we're at block height 765494. Colin's throwing around his new wedding ring that he's getting accustomed to.
It's too small. I need to get it, or it's too large. I need to get it resized. But
yeah, that's something you want to do ahead of time. Yeah. I don't know. Unless it's a shotgun wedding. So I don't know your personal side. To each their own. We are looking at an awesome downward difficulty adjustment, about a little under 8%, which is very, very exciting. And we're hovering around total exahash of about 250. We're going to go down five topics this week and kind of keep it tight. These shows will be probably max 60 minutes, so you'll be able to get hopefully a lot of great content within that 60 minutes. And let's just start right off the bat. Hash rate is down quite a bit. It's about 13 to 14% from the all-time high of around, I want to say, on the 30-day moving average, about 275 exahash. We're going to discuss some ideas on why this is. So that's the first topic we're going to cover. Second of the five is the hash price being at an all-time low territory. We're going to explain what this is and why it matters. Third, which is probably the most important part, or one of the most important parts of getting into mining, is the entry price that you deploy your capital. So ASICs obviously being the most probably capital-intensive portion. So it's ASICs, ASICs, ASICs. And on the positive side, Christmas came early for many folks, where you can find some exceptional deals. Fourth, from my friend Zach Vol, who does a monthly mining recap. It's been a pretty shitty month for Bitcoin mining, so we're going to just touch on that. A couple specific things is around CoreSci and Iris Energy. And then fifth, we'll go into the details of the Compute North bankruptcy, asset sale, and what that means. And if we have some time, we may riff on a couple ideas. I may ask Colin for his end-of-year price prediction, which when did you do that price prediction, total exahash prediction? When was that with the team?
That's a really good question. I want to say that was back in either late spring or early summer. Maybe it was around May. Yeah. It was sometime around then. I can try to find it on the blog, but yeah, I mean, my prediction in that article was like 255. The low ball prediction from our CTO is 250. That's Eddie Wang. And Nick Hansen, our CEO, he was predicting, I think, like 282. So,
damn, that's a tight band between all you guys.
Yeah.
All right. So let's continue talking through the hash rate. So it's down. Miners like myself, let's go juice it up, baby. Why do you think, hash rate, total exahash, is down?
Yeah, so it's the biggest part of this. Well, there are two components. One is that energy prices are still on a tear. They're starting to kind of plateau, but the fact of the matter is your average hosting rate in 2022 has been, and this is for retail usually. The bigger miners can usually get a better deal, but sometimes not. It's like 8 or 9 cents a kilowatt hour. And last year it was about 6 or 7. And the year before that, you were looking at 5 or 6 cents a kilowatt hour. So as energy prices go up, hash price, which is a measure of mining revenue potential, Basically, what hash price does is it takes all of the inputs that matter to miners. It takes Bitcoin difficulty. It takes transaction fees. It takes Bitcoin price, and it consolidates all of those into a single metric that shows you how much money you can expect to make from a unit of hash rate when hashing at an FPPS pool like Luxor. FPPS is full paper share.
Yeah, and just to double click there, can you explain FPPS versus I think what's the other
PPLNS? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So PPLNS is the oldest payment scheme in the book for Bitcoin mining pools, Slush Pool, first Bitcoin mining pool. That's what they've used since inception, I believe. And PPLNS basically, it stands for pay per last in share. And what that means is a proportionate to your hash rate and how long you've been on the pool, you will get paid a certain amount of money based on how many blocks Slush Pool mines. So what this does for the miner is if you're a miner and you're doing PPLNS, then you are exposing yourself to the luck risk of that pool. Obviously, sometimes a pool mines more or fewer or more blocks based on their luck. And if you're doing PPLNS, then that luck is transferred to you as a miner. FPPS abstracts this away for the miner. FPPS stands for full paper share, which means that you get a slice of transaction fees and block rewards proportionate to your hash rate to the pool, regardless of what happens to the pool. So if the pool is unlucky 1 week or super lucky the other week, you're getting paid the same regardless. And that's based on, for us, our hash price and, you know, other companies, they have their own. They have hash price. They don't use our index, but hash price is basically just a metric to measure that revenue potential. And so, if we look at hash price right now, it's at 6 cents per terahash or $60 per petahash. And so, for those of you who don't know the nuances between petahash and terahash, that's not really important. What's important to know about that is, though, if you're using a 100 terahash miner like the S19J Pro, you're only making $6 a day in revenue right now. Compare this to last year, where the average was $30 a day.
God bless.
Or at the peak, $42, right? So, like, this time last year, miners were printing money. I mean, they were making, like, $40 a day, $38 a day, something like that. And so, right now, this hash price is actually at an all-time low, so mining margins have never been thinner. And the recent drop in hash rate that we've seen, we went from 274 exahash is a second on the 7-day moving average down. That was like 2.5 weeks ago. Now we're at, like you said, about 240 or so on the 7-day. Basically, all of those machines that are coming offline are no longer profitable because, like I was saying, if you have an average hosting rate, like 8 or 9 cents, at 8 cents, you're break even right now based on the hash price. At 9 cents, you're underwater. And anything above that, you're going to be underwater. And Kareem Helmy, formerly of Coinmetrics, has this brilliant nonce analysis that's proprietary. You can't find it online. Sorry, guys. He's going to monetize it as he should because it's a crazy thing. He basically looks at the nonce patterns that we see for the blocks that get produced. And then he deduces from those nonce patterns what percentage of the network is a given machine. And he was Holy shit. Yeah, it's crazy. He was saying in a mining chat that I'm in this morning that about 13 exahashes worth of S19J Pros went offline over the last couple of weeks.
Repeat that one more time.
So 13 exahashes of S19J Pros went offline in the recent weeks. And that's like 130,000 machines.
So round numbers, we were at an all-time high around 275. We're hovering around 240, 250.
Yeah.
So that's a delta of 25, let's say, round numbers. So 50% of the machines that came offline were these S19J Pros.
Yes, according to Kareem. And I believe that and I trust that. And a lot of that's probably coming from the U.S. We had this massive Bitcoin mining gold rush in the last 2 years after, or really last year and this year when China banned Bitcoin mining. A lot of that came here. A lot of people got into the industry. And a lot of people took on exorbitant hosting rates. And they did so because it was so dummy profitable to mine. I mean, the margins last year were insane, right? Like, it cost at 8 cents, it cost something like I don't know, like $3.50 to run one of these machines. And you were making $30 a day on average last year.
I remember on Twitter, people were firing up S9s and selling them for like, I don't even know what, maybe 300, 500
Yeah, 300,
bucks.
400 bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like at the peak last year, it was probably around 500.
Yeah. Yeah. And plug now them those, in your garage.
And now
plug
those machines are selling for like $50. And like sooner or later, they're going to be just giveaways because they're just
paperweights.
They're no longer profitable. They are paperweights. So, I mean, we're basically just a, paint a picture for those who don't mine. I mean, there's never been a worse time to mine in terms of like margins.
And this is an audio only podcast, and you're looking at somebody right now that is knee deep in Bitcoin mining. So thanks, Colin. That's great. And
well, the other side of this, though, you know, is if you were looking to get into Bitcoin mining, which, you know, like this is not financial advice. Because the biggest problem right now is just finding cheap enough electricity.
Yeah.
Right?
Before we go into that, because that's like we're going to go into ASICs and so on, which is great. I do want to like continue down the hash rate going down, and I'd be curious to know do you see this as a plateauing? Do you see this continued pain where exahashes, the S19J Pros, other machines, and more specifically, do you see total exahash continuing this decline over time?
Long term, no. Short term, conceivably, because the problem is like, you know,
well, sure. Long term, no. I would hope total exahash goes up.
Right. But it'll be. I guess here's how I would answer that: is like it's going to be slower than people expected last year. Like everyone expected us to be at 300 exahash.
Sorry, the slower the decline or the slower the growth? You mean?
Yeah, slower the growth. Yeah.
Okay.
Because like, and we would be careful not to have like just totally an American centric view on these things, right? Because I mean, America is at this point, the US and Canada combined have like probably 50% of the network hash rate, or at least they have at some point this year. I don't know if that still stands with all these machines coming offline. But all of that being said, you know, we're higher cost power, even in the cheaper places like Texas, right? You know, 7, 8, 9 cents, that's high right now. And meanwhile, you have guys in Latin America who are getting power for, you know, 2, 3, 4 cents and maybe even lower in some cases. And there's even rumors that, you know, there are nat gas miners in Russia. And that's where some people think that's where a lot of this recent hash rate bump came from. Like we went from like 240 to 270 like really quickly. And a lot of people think that that's Russians getting in because there are no investment opportunities right now because of the sanctions clamping down on, you know, capital markets over there and things like that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
By the way, random, but is El Salvador, are they mining Bitcoin right now?
I have no idea.
No idea.
I mean, like probably. I don't think it's scale. That whole thing to me just seems like be a big PR campaign. Mm-hmm. I have not really seen anything major there. So I'm sure they're mining some, but like not anything to make any sort of difference, right?
Bitcoin mining is so interesting to me because it, other than the barrier to entry of buying the machines, which there is, because it takes a good amount of capital even to buy one machine. And then to get it there, high quality from a high quality broker or manufacturer, and then finding a place for consistent and reliable energy, which I think is where you're going to on this the second point. But what's cool is you could be very entrepreneurial in, let's say, you know, Central America, South America, Africa, heck, even Antarctica. I don't know, and plugging in these machines and then participating. In the whole Bitcoin mining world.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some really creative stuff. I mean, there's a guy in Mexico who's using biomass from pig shit. What's up?
Do tell.
Yeah, like, so I mean, basically, it's pretty simple. I mean, he's getting his fuel from farmers that's basically just like manure and other like agricultural waste, and he's putting it into these biodigesters, and methane comes out, and he uses it to power generators, right? So if you could find edges like that, obviously,
exactly.
you'll be good. And then we have another partner in, I think, Kenya, where like they're using like a small hydro power station to basically to mine Bitcoin and then use that Bitcoin mine as like a load resource. So they can actually like run the hydro at profit. And then when people in the villages need the excess energy, the miners can just shut off. So
Tom, I'm creating a new segment on the fly, which is like the cool pig shit segment, where it's like how you're doing cool Bitcoin mining, and we just highlight one at-home miner or mining operation. That's awesome.
I think that would be a fun. I've wanted to do that at Luxor. I just don't know if I'm going to have time to, like, miners around the world series, where you just, like, get some of these guys in and you just talk to them about, like, everything that they've done. I just probably gave you some content and you're just doing a show idea.
Yeah, that's a new show, new podcast. I've got Builders in Bitcoin. I got this policy. I got this week in Bitcoin and policy. Now I got Pod 256 and now miners around the world. No, I'm good. I think I'm good on podcasts. So you explained, so we went through the hash rate. That was great. Hash price being at an all-time low. You think there's still more pressure to come, by the way, and on the hash price?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we haven't seen the Bitcoin bottom, then that's just going to negatively impact dollar-denominated hash price. So there's two ways to measure hash price. The brains guys call it hash price for dollars, and they call it hash value for Bitcoin, but, like, we don't do that over here. We just say Bitcoin-denominated or USD-denominated. So, like, you can do USD-denominated, and, like I said, right now it's at, like, you know, $50 or $60 per petahash per day. If we look at BTC denominated, I'm just going to do in terahash because this really hammers it home. Mm-hmm. Right now, you're only making 351 sats per terahash.
Oof.
Yeah, right? That's rough.
Where does that oof mean? Meme, Tom. Yeah. Just put that in. Oof. Like, yeah.
Like the, like, Easter Island heads or something. Like,
well, no, not even that. There's, like, the soccer coach that's, like, on the sideline. I think he's, like, Portugal or Spain's coach. He's like, oof.
Right. So all that being said, you know, if Bitcoin's price goes up, then your dollar-denominated hash price goes up. If difficulty goes up, though, then your Bitcoin-denominated hash price goes down. Mm-hmm. So the double whammy is Bitcoin is tanking and difficulty is going up. And that's what we've been getting a lot this year. I think that, you know, thankfully on the difficulty front, at least for the rest of December, we'll probably be okay. I don't think that we've seen the bottom for hash price this cycle. I mean, last time it was like $70 per petahash per day, and that was like right after the halving.
Yep.
And then we ripped, and then so it went up. So
as I talk to, like, friends and family and potential people that want to do some of these mining deals with me, there's four quadrants. And three of them are good, and then there's one quadrant that's the baddie quadrant. And I explained this when I was Marty was kind enough to have me on his podcast. The baddie quadrant is the one you just explained, which is where total exahash goes up and the Bitcoin price goes down. That is no bueno. And that's where we've been squarely as at-home miners to publicly traded mining companies. If you don't have your unit economics and discipline in place, Christmas is not going to be fun.
No, absolutely. The good news is that, like, Bitcoin is a ecosystem of equilibrium, right? Like, the difficulty adjustment is the heartbeat of the net. Well, I'm not going to – I don't want to do an analogy that I'll probably regret later because it's complicated. But the difficulty adjustment kind of proves this or contributes to this equilibrium, right? Like, more miners come onto the network, difficulty goes up. More miners come off the network, difficulty goes down. And in either of those scenarios, like when it goes down, you have hash price getting a boost. So when it becomes less profitable to mine, then naturally miners who are higher up the cost ladder shut off. So I think that's the one thing that is really going to help us at least make this stomachable for some miners, or at least middle-of-the-road miners. But the other problem is too, obviously, for every miner that has, you know, 6-7 cent costs, there are other miners who are mining near zero. I mean, there are miners out there whose energy cost is basically nothing, and they're never going to shut off. Mm-hmm. And they're just going to try to keep getting machines to keep building up their hash rate and, you know,
where is that share. Out of curiosity?
So Russia is an example, assuming that's happening.
Yep.
I find it plausible. I mean, some people I trust have said that they see that happening. Energy producers are another one here. I mean, like, the energy's not free. But if it's going to be free for anyone, it's free for them, right? They're already producing it, and there's an excess. So you run machines on that, and you're just skimming cream off the top. And the last one, there are still miners in China, and those guys are operating on hydro dams that are either on the grid or off the grid. And, you know, besides basically bribing the officials mm-hmm. and the people who run the facility, you know, they don't really have too much in the ways of cost, so...
we'll close here. If you're looking to get into Bitcoin mining and you think it's like profitable at like 7.9 cents a kilowatt hour, or 8.9 or whatever, from my own experience, move that cost down way, way low. Try to get it as close to, you know, as cheap as possible, even if you're spending a little bit more on the, let's say, the machines, because your consistent cost basis is, I think, the most important thing, and obviously your entry point on what you buy the cap, your machines for that as well, because something like the Batty quadrant will happen, which is when total exahash starts ripping in your face, and then the total the Bitcoin price starts dropping. And actually, Drew Armstrong, and I didn't put this in our little chat, he had a good tweet thread, Drew Armstrong from Cathedra. Bitcoin, and it was around basically the long and the short of it was a lot of these folks prepay their monthly hosting, so they don't have a real incentive to turn off the machines, even though they're, you know, unprofitable until the following month, because they've already paid for that hosting. So I'd be curious to see if, like, I mean, we're at 16k or whatever, maybe 17k a Bitcoin price, that to see more and more of these miners shutting off.
Yeah, that's a good point from Drew. And to kind of expand on that, the big guys, like the big public miners and big private miners who have power purchasing agreements, they have deposits, right?
Yeah, yeah.
With the energy company. So in some cases, it makes more sense for them to eat the negative margin on what they're mining if their power costs go above the cost of production, than to lose that deposit, because they have to consume a certain amount of energy or else the power company takes that deposit. So just to add to that, that's another example of where you might see like hash rate, you know, hash rate typically lags downward movements in hash price or upward movements in hash price as actors, as miners, you know, react to what's happening.
Yep. We're going to put this, his tweet thread in the show notes, Tom. I just pulled it up as well. Speaking of Christmas, by the way, for those that are looking to buy some miners, they're going to be probably finding some really good deals. I mean, I've been DCAing Bitcoin miners, not the top, fortunately, but near the top, all the way down to this bottom portion right now where we're at. But I don't know if you want to shed some light on the type of machines that you're seeing and some of the values there.
Yeah, so new generation ASICs, so those are things like your 86 to 100 and, you know, 100 and, well, yeah. The S19 XP, I kind of put in like a, it's new gen, but like, we'll call it like.
That's a new gen?
Yeah, that's a new gen, because it's so, the efficiency is pretty good compared to the, I mean, it's like 21 joules per terahash. So 21 watts per terahash of compute power that you're consuming. And that's versus like, you know, 28 to 30 for some of the, or 38, like 28 to 38 for like new gens, like the S19J Pro, M30S++ and things like that. But anyway, so those new gen machines that started coming out in like 2019, like 2019, 2020, they are going for all-time low valuations right now. Last cycle or right before, in 2020, they were selling for, you know, about like $21 per terahash, $20 per terahash. Right now on Luxor's or Hashrate Index's ASIC price index, y'all can see it, hashrateindex.com/ASIC index data. The average listing price right now is like $19 per terahash. But if you go to certain brokers like Luxor or other companies,
Kaboom Racks is one.
Kaboom Racks is another, or Compass. If you go to these guys, you know, we have some listed right now. We have an S19 listed for $13 per terahash. The efficiency on that isn't very good. It's 34 compared to some of the other stuff. We have a WhatsMiner M30S Plus for $15 per terahash. So just to give you guys an idea.
Wait, M30S Plus, is that the 100?
It's 102.
102, okay.
It's just God, a little note about like minor differences, like minor differences in miners, just to have a little wordplay there. Yeah. If anyone's laughing, they're probably not. There's like all of these different names. Like there's S19J Pro, there's S19, there's S19 Pro, there's M30S Plus, there's M30S Plus, there's M30S. And basically that's just like each machine has a different caliber of chip in it. And so like when these companies buy wafers from chip producers, they have all different types of, you know, like some of them are more efficient than others. And so they'll just repackage the less efficient chips into a similar model and just name it something different. So there's all these little nuances in their actual output. But, you know, for like the $15 per terahash M30S Plus, you know, you're looking at like, you know, like $1,800 for that.
One area I love going to insights.brains2eyes.com and then clicking on their profitability calculator and then taking one of these machines and then plugging it in and just getting what your payback period is. The more important thing is, again, going back to the energy source, is consistent and reliable price per kilowatt. I want to go back to actually our first point, which was around the total exahash going down. You made a good point where I think in 2020, we were around 5 to 6 cents. And 21 was like 6 to 7 cents. And now in 2022, on retail and potentially on commercial scale, we're in this like 8 to 9 cent range. Do you envision the price per kilowatt also plateauing or even decreasing over time, where there's more competition and more energy producers out there potentially soliciting these energy pirates to come in and mine Bitcoin?
It depends if, at least in the U.S. context, if certain states and the U.S. and the federal government can get their shit together in terms of energy policy. Like, let's like look at Texas really quickly. Texas has a lot of energy producing assets. They've got a lot of natural gas. They've also got a lot of renewables that have been built out in West Texas, like solar and wind. A lot of those renewables were built out because the federal government has been incentivizing, you know, green energy, right? Renewable energy. Renewable energy at scale, at least in my opinion, doesn't make as much sense in, when you compare it to other reliable baseloads like nuclear and nat gas. And, you know, for certain, you know, if you want solar panels on your home or on a microgrid in your neighborhood, great. Like, I think that makes sense. Wind energy in places that actually have enough wind to produce a reliable amount of energy, great. But to go back to my original point, there was so much investment in this green energy, and there was a lot of it in Texas. And you had these Bitcoin miners moving out there, some of them going on wind farms and things like that. And then in the winter, you know, there's a cold snap, they don't run. And then the same thing in the summer. There's a heat wave. There's no wind blowing. The wind stops. And ERCOT, Texas's independent power authority, they have a certain amount of their energy demand budgeted to come from wind. You know, it's like 20% or something on a good day. And when that drops to zero, what happens? Well, prices go up, right? So I guess all of that to say, if we have reliable baseloads like nuclear, hydro can be another one so long as there aren't droughts. And that gas, and you know, God forbid to some people, but stuff like coal, you know, those typically produce energy at much cheaper rates than stuff like renewables. This is why Europe will never be a reliable mining hub. They don't have, they don't frack, so they don't have nat gas, and they have to buy their nat gas from places like Russia or the U.S. And they have so much renewable penetration that their grids are breaking. So, you know, in terms of cost per kilowatt, I think that if inflation gets under control and we continue to build out things like nuclear and reliable energy loads, then, yeah, I mean, it should be okay. Tennessee is a great example for this. The majority of our power comes from nuclear.
45%.
People don't know this. It's the majority comes from nuclear. A lot comes from hydro. The rest comes from nat gas. We have very little coal in this country or in this state. And so— Yeah, I guess to wrap that up, places with reliable grids will have cheaper energy, and that's where the miners will go.
Any, not to put you on the spot, but any take on like small modular reactors or?
I don't know enough about it, but a lot of the people that I trust, like Harry's a guy who's
talked about
this.
Big brain.
Yeah, to me, they seem like they're going to be a big part of moving towards a more sustainable and renewable energy future, right? And when I say sustainable and renewable, I do count nuclear as a renewable energy.
Totally. All right. So that was a little bit of positivity. Let's go to the negativity and the basically kind of shitty month for Bitcoin mining. Friend Zach Vole with Brains, you got to go check him out and give him a follow. He posted a tweet here. November was a remarkably shit month for mining. Just a couple highlights here that we'll jump into. One of those is, by the way, on the This Week in Bitcoin and Policy podcast, we Grant and I talked about the New York governor finally signing the 2-year moratorium on new mining projects. Any take on that or anything else you're hearing about miners in New York?
Not really. I know that Greenidge, they have a big presence there and they're kind of in trouble financially. Take that with a grain of salt, because it's not like they've come out and said, we're going insolvent, but they have a really high debt to equity ratio. And the fact that New York, I think they're grandfathered in to what New York is doing. But to me, it seems like all signs lead to New York being a hostile place for miners, which is really sad because it's really starting to come down between on party lines. Like you have people in blue states who are saying we don't want this. And you have people in red states saying either we don't care or we actively want this. That's not to say that we haven't had our own problems in places like Tennessee. I mean, they're, I don't remember who it was. I think maybe it was Grid, but like they're in like some rural town and like they didn't do noise. I don't know if it was Grid. It was someone and they didn't do noise mitigation very well. And so like everyone was pissed off at them, which is like very, that's a fair claim. Like, you know, like
100%. And these are the things that you learn from and you need to engage in your community and not be an asshole and figure it out. One other area that was really interesting to me on this list was, Iris Energy was unable to service their loans and then they unplugged their machines. I think, and again, I want to, if someone fact check me, and maybe you can fact check me, but they were one of the companies that collateralized their miners to get investment and then make those investments. And they couldn't pay that loan back. So then they had to return thousands of miners back to their lender.
Yeah, back to NYDIG.
Oof.
Yeah, so...
Double oof, Tom.
And that's another interesting... That's going to be a quick tangent before I hit on that. Like NYDIG, Foundry also does ASIC loans, and like so does Galaxy. These lenders are going to just have boatloads of ASICs. And the play for them going...
Do they broker ASICs right now? Do they have a brokerage shop or a partner?
No, they just issue the loans and then claw back the ASICs when the loans get defaulted.
But are they building out broker teams or sales teams to them?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't think so though. But basically like guys like Foundry, and this is why I'll hit on this again when we talk about the bankruptcy auction. Like Foundry and NYDIG at Galaxy, BlockFi, if they were solvent, you know, they're going to have all of these ASICs and the only thing for them to do is either to sell them, which they're probably not going to want to do. They'll sell some of them, but they're going to want to start mining with these, right? Because they need to get a return on that capital that they lent out, right?
But the hosting is not included with the miners.
No, no, it's not. But what I'm saying is they're going to take the miners back and then they're going to try to find a place to host
Got
them.
It.
Or in Foundry's case, buy some Bitcoin sites from a bankrupt company and then host them there. But anyway, going back to your original thing. Yeah, so what some people might not know is that like, one of the more common ways in the last bull market to acquire ASICs were from these ASIC financing deals. And to your point, so there are different financiers. Like there's Foundry was one of them, BlockFi was another, Galaxy was one, and then NYDIG was another. And there are a few other smaller shops. And what these deals basically would say is, okay, we're going to give you like several, you know, however many millions of dollars. And you are going to use that to buy ASICs. And then that loan is going to be collateralized with ASICs too. So now we're in a position where those ASICs aren't making nearly enough money. And also the price of ASICs are tanking, right? Like Core Scientific is a good example here. They bought a bunch of S19s when they were like at the top last year for like $10,000 a pop. Well, now those machines are worth 80 to 90% less.
Yep.
And so it's just, and so these deals have loan to value ratios. I don't know what they typically are. It varies by lender, but so like, it's like getting margin called on a position. So when the value of ASICs go down, and Luxor's ASIC price index is actually used as a reference point for mark to market for these things, as the values of ASICs go down, then they have to commit more ASICs as collateral. But the problem is this isn't like Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin's an extremely liquid commodity. ASICs are not very liquid. You know, you have to go through a broker, do OTC to try to sell them. Right now, you know, last quarter or like in October, through our ASIC brokerage desk, it was kind of brutal because everyone was waiting for the prices to go down before they bought. So right now you don't have as many buyers. So what happens when these loans get defaulted on, as you were talking about at the beginning, like with Iris, then the lender, in this case, NYDIG, and this also happened with Stronghold. Stronghold defaulted on, I think, 26,000 S19J Pros in September or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
NYDIG just takes those machines back. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see this more like Iris, $103 million worth of loans. It looks like they're – I don't think they've said that they've definitively defaulted on them, but it looks like they're about to, or at least they haven't announced it, but that all signs are pointed to that. And then Greenidge has like – $81 million or like $93 million worth of loans that they could potentially default on as margins just keep getting crushed. And one more thing to point out about these loans, you know, in the bull market, great, take it out, whatever. Yeah. Everyone's rolling in cash because hash price is super high. But like sometimes like these loans, typically the lowest one that I've seen in my research is like 9.5% and they get sometimes as high as 20%, you know? So I mean, right now you just
it's like getting a credit card and like they are paying the APR of like 20-some% on a credit card and then taking out the cash on a credit card and then going, let's go YOLO long at 69K a pop or $100+ a terahash. And then oof. We need the on the soundboard, by the way, the oof meme. But sorry, go ahead and call them.
No, that's basically it. This is something that I'm tracking. I hope to have a piece out on Hash Rate Index either next week or the week after.
Awesome.
Because these are probably the worst loans that a miner could take out because they have such a high interest rate.
Especially in the Batty quadrant.
Yeah, yeah. That's not to say that they're always terrible. Like if you're good at risk management and you have cash on the side and on your balance sheet and you have a rainy day fund for when, you know, hash price just gets shit kicked like it is now and you can pay it back and you didn't take out too many, then that's fine. But for someone like Iris Energy to have $103 million outstanding in this, it's just kind of crazy.
Okay, let's keep talking about potential bankruptcies and actually talk about one that is, which is Compute North, their bankruptcy asset sale. A lot of people, including myself, don't really know what's happening with them. Maybe you can shed some light.
Yeah, so this is convenient, and I will shill our newsletter here because I'm going to be releasing – but I'm writing about this for our blog, and I'm going to send a newsletter out on it in, early next week, probably Monday. So Compute North was probably the second largest host in Bitcoin mining in the U.S.
So number one was Riot, probably?
No, CoreSci. Riot's big, but they're not as big as those two were.
Oh, in terms of hosting provider.
Yeah. So, okay, Riot's probably at this point, next to Marathon, the biggest miner in the U.S.
Okay.
Because Marathon's actually seems to be deploying more machines now, whereas they had trouble with that earlier in the year. But anyway, so Compute North filed for bankruptcy in September. Compute North held machines from guys like Marathon, from a lot of private miners. They had considerable they had a lot of capacity being consumed. Like they had one of their facilities had up to 100 megawatts worth of capacity. Another one had 13 megawatts. Another had 7. And they had a bunch in development, like 300 megawatts under development, 280 under development, 300 under development, and then 35 under development. So a lot. Basically what happened is they did not lock in long-term power purchasing agreements.
Oof.
Yeah, so their power purchasing agreement was variable. And people always ask, like, how could this happen? And Ethan, our COO, explained to me that a lot of guys in 2020 and 2021 had these power pricing projections that showed the price of power going down. Like, there was a downtrend long-term when they were looking at, like, the last, like, what I call it, 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of them were saying, okay, well, like it might be half a cent less or whatever next year. So I'm not going to lock in a long-term agreement because I can potentially lock in a better rate next year or, you know, the variable rate will go down. Well, then, you know, energy inflation kicked up and that didn't happen. And Compute North had to raise its power rates so much that they were no longer making any money. And when Generate Capital, their largest lender, figured this out, Generate Capital shut down, I think it was like a $300 million revolving line of credit. Eesh. Yeah. And Compute North owed Generate Capital at the time of the filing $101 million.
So they just took over the business.
Yeah. So Generate Capital, they had a secured loan with Compute North, and that loan was secured by their Compute North's Kearney, Nebraska facility, which is 100 megawatts, and also the Granbury, Texas, also called Wolf Hollow facility, which is up to 300 megawatts. This is just partially operational.
So now Generate Capital owns those two facilities?
Yeah, correct. Okay. And in the bankrupt, so Compute North went bankrupt and they filed for Chapter 11, and then they just completed their 363 asset sale. And this is basically just an auction.
363 assets, what's that mean?
It's just a bankruptcy auction. Okay. So it's like, it's overseen by the legal system. You appoint someone to run the auction for the debtor, in this case, Compute North. And then creditors and other actors can come in and bid on assets. Mm-hmm. Now, in Compute North's case, most of the people bidding were actually creditors themselves. Like, for instance, Generate Capital. They came in and bought $5 million worth of assets. So I think that includes like transformers, containers.
Oh, interesting.
And miners and things like that. And they also got the Kearney, Nebraska and Granbury, Texas facilities. So, wow. Yeah. So, and they loaned Compute, they had 101 outstanding in loans to Compute North. So they paid $5 million in the asset sale, but really they're out $106 million.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Something similar happened where Foundry had something like $8 million in an outstanding equipment loan, an ASIC loan to Compute North. And they bid on assets and also basically bid on that liability too.
Yep.
So they're
just owed to them.
Exactly. So yeah. They're just stomaching that loss. But what they get in return is they get Big Spring, Texas facility, which is 13 megawatts. They get a North Sioux City facility, which is 7 megawatts in North Dakota. And they also have the rights to purchase, if they choose, a facility in Minden, Nebraska, for this is up to 35 megawatts. This is in development. And they only paid, I think it was it $4 million? Yeah, they paid...
But they're taking on millions of dollars of liability.
Right, right.
And so, sorry, going back to Generate, is the Granbury site online right now?
Yes, Granbury is online, but it's partially operational. It's not fully operational. And the Kearney, Nebraska facility is 100% energized and operational.
So that's – okay, so just breaking this down because I'm really curious about this – a lot of the stuff that the people are buying, if it's fully operational, I think it's a win. The mm-hmm. stuff that's in development is a little bit scary, plus the liability, right. Because you need to then rely on folks to bring a transformer or build a container or, the team to energize the site and all these different variables that could still go wrong. But I don't know about Generate Capital, but Foundry's a proven team over there that can, run a successful mining operation. So I'm going to be curious to follow along on those.
Yeah. And to follow up on the Foundry thing and to touch back on the ASIC financing loans, right? That loan that's outstanding for $8 million, what is Foundry going to do with those ASIC? Compute North's already defaulting on the loan. It was secured by collateral. I think that collateral is just the machines. Maybe it's Bitcoin or cash, but they didn't say in the bankruptcy filing. So Foundry's going to rake back that collateral. Now they have the machines. Are they going to sell them or are they going to mine with them? And that's what they're doing here.
Does Foundry offer hosted mine solutions?
No.
Okay.
No. Foundry's whole thing is finance your ASICs with us and then you have to use our pool.
Got it.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Well, it'd be interesting because now they're holding this massive asset we'll see how it plays out. Kevin, I'm going to hit you up.
You should ask them what they're planning to do because these facilities are turnkey and I would assume that for whatever machines they have clawed back from this defaulted loan that are not turnkey, they're going to try to put them in Minden if they decide it's worthwhile to complete the build out and energize it, right? Because that's the big question. That's probably why, to your point, that they didn't totally pull the trigger on Minden.
Yeah,
because it's in development still. And so they're trying to figure out, does this actually make sense economically?
Do we sell the parts or do we continue to develop it or do we just walk away?
Yeah, exactly.
For sure.
And so one last thing to point out here, or a few more things to point out. The other facilities that were up for sale include one called King Mountain in McCamey, Texas. This was purchased by a group called US Data Group, which is affiliated with US Bitcoin Group, which is a miner here in the US. And they purchased it for $10 million, $3 million of which goes directly to Compute North to pay down other creditors. The other $7 million of which goes to pay down a debt of $99 million that Compute North has with NextEra Energy Company. And so Compute North had a joint venture with NextEra to build out this site. NextEra is, I believe, a renewables-focused company in West Texas. And they have a $99 million secured promissory note, Compute North does, to NextEra. And so US Data Group is also assuming this. So the two biggest debts that Compute North had with Generate Capital and with NextEra have been assumed. In the former's case, by the actual lender of the loan, Generate Capital is just stomaching that. And then on the other side, by US Data Group, which is assuming the note that Compute North owns to NextEra. So they've essentially paid $10 million plus assuming the liability of a $99 million note. And after all of this is said and done, so far from the asset sale, Compute North has raised $21.7 million. And I think actually $7 million of that is from US Data Group. So it's really more like they've raised like $14.7
million. So Compute North is done. That brand
Compute North is done. Okay. They've got $14.7 million in cash from the sale. At the time of the bankruptcy filing, I think they had like another $4 or $5 million in the bank. Some of that will go towards payroll expenses, winding down the company. I think they're still operating. Like some people are still hashing. So they're going to be eating the difference in what they're paying for the electricity and what. So that's another important thing. Compute North's power bill went up, but they couldn't actually pass that on to the customer, because they had in their contracts that they couldn't raise the electricity rate. So they're eating that difference, and then they have to pay a bunch of court fees. But right now, in terms of unsecured obligations, so basically all of the secured obligations are wiped out. So Compute North is good there. Those have been covered. But they've got another $40 million, $39.3 million in unsecured debt. And I believe that Marathon Digital holds like $21 million of that. They're going to get paid back, you know, cents on the dollar for that debt. Along with there are like 59 other creditors.
Folks, where you mine matters and who you partner with matters so dang much.
Yep.
So like to your point, which you alluded to when we were talking about New York, and it's unfortunate because it is going down it's more going down a pro-business, pro-growth versus like a versus pro-regulation and pro-creating more rules and more barriers to entry. Like I actually had a deal that came across me. I was like, hey, you know, here's some of the stats and blah, 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 which looked interesting. And they said it was mining in a very blue state. And I was like, that's a full stop, no go for me. And not to disrespect any of these countries, but like, I just don't have the opportunity, or would I, to go mine in Russia or Kazakhstan or whatever. Right. I look at those states in the similar vein. I don't want to be rug pulled after I put in like a lot of capital and a lot of my time and energy. Whereas I'll take that risk in states like Tennessee, Texas, and other places like that.
Yeah.
And then just one real last quick point, it is like where you mine, but also who you mine with. So like having diversification with like, you know, whether it's like Compute North or, you know, maybe even a hosting provider, like a River, or there's the Compass, like Compass Rug. And I hate to say that, you know, but like getting into bad contracts, then trusting folks to execute across the way, doing your research on this area is so important. So like starting even with a BS S9 at home and seeing how Bitcoin mining works so that you can really understand the full aspects of all the variables that can make your mining operation go to zero is mission critical.
Yeah, 100%. And we're really starting to, the industry in the US is starting to learn a lot of painful lessons. Like you said, like making sure that you're mining with the right person. Like, do they have long-term PPAs in place?
That's the first question.
Yeah. And then, you know, but there's some people who did things like, you know, through, they would go through Compass and they decided to buy miners in Russia. And
well, And sorry, go ahead.
So I guess to that point, like, I'm not defending Compass because I think that the retail model for this is just fraught with risk and it just sounds like a bad idea. But then some people were like, oh, I'll get cheaper power rates if I like mine in Russia. And it's like, well, there's a reason for that. And then sanctions hit and then bye-bye, your machines are gone.
Look, it's easier for me or you to point the finger, and especially being like, the Monday morning quarterback or Tuesday morning quarterback so on. And I've taken a lot of risk in my life, much of which is calculated, and I've been wrong a lot in my life. So like, but hopefully we can all learn from these situations where it's like looking at your kind of your principled like yes, no sheet to either make a decision to mine. It's like, all right, is it in the, let's say, a state that you're comfortable with, like US or wherever, El Salvador or XYZ? Okay, that's yes. Okay, is it in a jurisdiction that is that you're comfortable with? Okay, yes. Is your energy source consistent and reliable and fixed over a long period of time? Like, mining is not, in my humble opinion, because of the how high the CapEx is, depending on your scale. It's not a, oh, let's do this for like 3 months, 6 months. I mean, you know, some of the payback periods were calculated at between 22 and 26 months. Hopefully we get to those points, but I don't think that's the case. You just want to be in it for the long term. And I do think we're going to see a big washout, if you ask me my perspective, of the folks that were looking to make a quick dollar or fiat based buck rather than being able to mine and generate sats and stream sats over a long period of time. And for someone like me, that's really helpful.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there are a lot of pedestrian investors that looked at how stupid the profit margins were last year. And in a lot of these decks to other investors, they were using current mining profitability to project future mining profitability, right?
Totally.
And it's super volatile, obviously, right? It's subject to Bitcoin's price. It's subject to how much hash rate is on the network and what the difficulty is. And so, you know, last year, if you had machines online at the beginning of January, I was doing some analysis on this. Like, if you bought that machine in December, you ROI'd like in July.
Yeah.
Right. And so like it was super quick. And so everyone sees that and they cream their pants and they say, okay, well, I got to get in on this too. And now you're looking at ROI times. I don't even want to say what they are because they make me depressed. But like,
but the other thing is like going into those profitability calculators, which are awesome and a lot of fun to do. Did you ever put in a Bitcoin price going down
80%? Yeah, you got to.
No, okay.
Oh, did I do it?
Well, no, I don't think anyone.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You never put the negative sign in front of the Bitcoin price going down. You may have left it at zero, and you may have put total exahash going up by, I don't know, 5, 10,
20%. That's a good point.
And then all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, what about this scenario, Colin? What if that total exahash goes up, 50% and the price of Bitcoin goes down well over 50%, and you'd be like, well, I wouldn't do the deal. That'd be stupid, right, Rod?
Right.
Well, fast forward to December 1st, 2022, and that's where we're sitting.
Yeah, exactly.
But my man, this has been such a fun chat. We can go probably for another hour or so, but we got a hard stop. We got our friend Matt O'Dell coming in here about to record RHR, and I really appreciate you, man, for doing this.
I appreciate you having me on, Rod. This is super fun, and definitely we'll be back for future episodes.
Heck yeah, man. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Cheers.